But anyway, welcome everyone to the House of the Rising Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And yes, it's snowing here in Colorado. How's it doing out there in Oregon?
It's chilly, but on the coast here it's not snowing, but I know inland there's been a little bit here and there. So, yeah, but pleasant.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah.
Pleasant here also. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. And it's nice to look out and see a nice, you know, I mean, we don't get that much snow here in Pueblo, so it's always exciting to me.
Okay. So,
I enjoy it. I know up north where you lived, you got a lot more snow because you were farther north and closer to the mountains. But down here, we don't get it that often or that much. So
yeah.
It's kind of cool when we get it, and especially this Christmas. So, yay.
Nice.
I bet there's going to be a lot of good, what happens when it's like this and it's Christmas time, then people get the spirit of Christmas and then they go out and buy a lot of stuff. So local merchants really enjoy it when we do get snow because it makes it more Christmassy. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But, but for me, it's, you know, I'm Christmas all year, so.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, synchronistically, our mutual friend Dave Van Dyke, years ago when we were in high school, I think, made a wonderful little pen and ink drawing that I still have a copy of somewhere. I think he printed a copy of it. It's called Christmas is 365 Days a Year, and it's just this wonderful little cartoony kind of drawing. Anyway, but. Yeah, so but it is. It has to be, you know, constant if it's going to be real, huh? Right?
Well, it does. And what is, you know, I mean, that's, you know, Christmas is coming. The goose is getting fat. Please put a penny in the old man's hat. Did you ever sing that song in school?
I remember that one. Yes, yeah. It's been a while, but
Well, you know, it's interesting that it, you know, brings up all these altruistic thoughts of, you know, put a penny in the old man's hat, you know, or, you know, help the homeless or the poor or whatever. And we have such great examples, like from the story of the Ebenezer Scrooge and, you know, all these warnings of, you know, if you don't love, if you're not kind, if you're not good, then, you know, things are going to happen to you and, you know, you're going to see the error of your ways. But, you know, it doesn't seem to really be that way in the world. There's people don't see the error of their ways at all. And in fact, in a lot of cases, think that their ways are the right ways. And I think in general, you know, about things like, you know, in Denver, I know Jennifer Nuhulu has been, you know, upset about this, is that at night the police go and take blankets away from homeless people. The homeless people are sleeping on the street. The police come and take their tents and their blankets, and then they have no place to go.
Oh.
And, you know, it's very upsetting to see that kind of thing going on. And, you know, people do get up in arms. But, you know, think about just in general, if you were that police officer or those police officers and your job was, or you were ordered to, you know, go and take away blankets from homeless people, what would that do to your state of mind and your consciousness to be, you know, it'd be like being, you know, not as serious, but it's still the same exact thing as being a Nazi soldier and being told to go round up a family or bring, you know, people in that were, you know, obviously innocent. It has to do something to your heart and your mind to allow that kind of thinking and to buy into that kind of thinking. It really is sad. And, you know, I see that happening in our country now with the, you know, election of the dreaded ogre Donald Trump, that, you know, there's a lot of I, me, mine going on and justification for a lot of ill will against other people. And you know, it is disheartening it's dispiriting to think that way. And no wonder it's so painful. No wonder people in this world are in such agony because, you know, we're doing things that we just know is, you know, completely wrong, or know are completely wrong, but we still do them because we feel a civic duty for some reason. And, you know, it just is very, very difficult. And where do we fit in that? You know, when, you know, I know that no amount of action in the world is going to make it better. And the only thing that's going to change the world is to change my own mind about the world.
Yeah.
But
yeah, exactly.
That seems so ineffective, but it is very effective. It really does change things.
It does. And it really kind of ties into one of the more pragmatic ideas in A Course in Miracles, which is shared interest, because it doesn't really matter which political system or which, in any specifics, you know, those are essentially irrelevant, even though obviously we think it makes a huge difference. But of course, that's why, you know, A Course in Miracles is a very challenging curriculum, because it basically suggests that no matter what appears to be happening on the level of form within what we think of as, you know, the dream of space-time, usually we don't think of it as a dream, that's the problem.
No.
That becomes, you know, a classroom for us to look at the contents of our unconscious mind. But usually we don't see it that way, but basically the idea is that we can apply kindness regardless. And I think we all catch ourselves quite frequently, if we're honest, engaging in thoughts that are less than kind. And when we can see that and forgive ourselves, and then that lets everyone else off the hook as well as ourselves, when we, you know, or see that we're being less than mindful and make a point to be more mindful and to see where those unkindnesses, you know, really lead to our unhappiness. And that's really ultimately what it boils down to. It has nothing to do with behavior, although it often will manifest in behavior, but it's always about the kindness that, and the shared interest that we can find within our mind. And then, you know, like I say, then more often than not, that will reflect in, you know, some kind of behavior, whether it's just a smile to a passerby or an act of what we consider charity, or in the case of, you know, like you mentioned, the example with the police officers just doing their duty, there might be an occasion where either, you know, they ignore their orders or just you know, let something they consider inhumane go by, you know, well, in other words, not apply an order that you know, comply with an order that doesn't fit their conscience. That's sort of a perfect example of that. I think if you take it to a really extreme level, it's actually a historical situation that is a movie that, if you haven't seen it, it's just amazing. It's called The Man Who Saved the World. And it's about a Russian military officer who essentially saved the planet from World War III back in the mid-80s. There was a faulty software, and this is actually seems kind of timely, given it was Russian software, and it's been in the news lately, in terms of hacking anyway. But there was a faulty software program in Russian missile system back in the mid-80s that delivered a false positive to the radar systems of the bases across, you know, Russia, not once but five times simultaneously, showing that there were five incoming missiles. And, you know, the various stations around the northern part of, you know, the Russian country were reporting this. And the responsibility fell to one man who was in charge of that operation that evening, who was a, you know, high-ranking military official, who basically went against his orders and his mandate, which was to, no matter what, fire or retaliatory strike. And he said, no, I'm going to wait till there's visual confirmation of the incoming missiles, because, you know, they obviously had outposts that had people that were staffing these stations that could confirm when the missiles were at a specific location, you know, far northern latitudes and so forth, and they would be able to see them and have, you know, a visual confirmation. And that was not the protocol. And so he went against the protocol, and because he did, you and I are sitting here, and everyone on the planet. There's, you know, what, about 7 billion plus of us that really owe this man a great deal of gratitude, because he had the presence of mind to ignore his mandate, his protocol, and you know, essentially require visual confirmation of an attack. And I think that's kind of a neat metaphor, really, for and it's a true story, but it is underreported. But it's a great movie. It's called Man Who Saved the World. If you haven't seen it.
It was what you were reminding me of was a movie that's fiction from the 80s, probably maybe 90s, was War Games, and Carrie mentioned it here on the board. Mm-hmm. From Matthew Broderick played in it. As he was a teenage kid who was a hacker, 1985, and he was playing games. He was playing games, and he accidentally hacked into the U.S. missile defense system. And when he hacked into the U.S. missile defense system, he didn't realize it, but he engaged in a game with the computer, and the computer was programmed. The guy who programmed the computer had started out with playing chess or checkers, playing checkers, I think, or no, not checkers, tic-tac-toe. Sorry, it was tic-tac-toe. So the program was started from the guy programming that, and then moved on and on and on until he got these war games, and they were playing these war games with the computer, but the computer didn't realize it. The kid was playing, he didn't realize it, and then the whole defense system came down and found the kid and everything, and you know, he had gotten this computer engaged in a game that was going to end up in nuclear war because it wouldn't stop. It wouldn't stop. The computer was convinced. And so the guy had to take it back. Man, I'm going to cry now. I don't know why. He had to take it back to the tic-tac-toe and let the computer play game after game after game of tic-tac-toe, until it realized that there was no possibility of a winner.
Uh-huh.
And when it realized there was no possibility of a winner, it stopped.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because it was mutually assured destruction.
Right.
And
which is, it has a perfect acronym, MAD.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Tiny
mad idea. And Carrie says that, remember the program's name? It was Jonathan. He named it after his son. The man named the program after his son, I believe. But yeah, it's when we realize that no one can win.
Right.
No one can win.
Exactly.
Then we stop.
Exactly.
But right now we're in a situation where, you know, people are terrified. People are scared to death in this country and in this world about what's happening politically.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, that's where we, as miracle workers, students of A Course in Miracles, and what you might want to call light workers or whatever, that's where we have to step up and recognize we have a job here. And, you know, our job is to bring about the end of the ego, and the only way to do that, and the ego is what runs the entire world, and the only way to do that is through forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And so when all these courses,
it really is I was just gonna say, and to okay. add to that, it the only responsibility is to accept that understanding for ourselves. We can't really do it for anyone else.
Correct.
but automatically, when we accept it for ourselves, it changes everything.
It changes
all of our relationships, because in that moment, we're no longer coming from a place of lack, which is really the only place war can come from. Speaking of holiday movies, that I think are very timely, another movie highly recommended. This is probably more of a holiday film rather than one I mentioned before, which is called Joyeux Noël. And it's a story about a ceasefire that happened on Christmas Eve, I believe it was, in Europe during World War One. And if you haven't seen it, it's a wonderful film, and it really speaks to shared interest. And there's a John McCutcheon song that it relates to it. It's called Christmas in the Trenches. If you can Google either of those, and you'll find them. And the Joyeux Noël movie is J-E-J-O-Y-E-A-U-X.
Okay, so it's French.
It's French. Yeah. But it's a wonderful film. If you haven't seen it, it's just, I highly recommend it. And it's just, you know, very, very touching, as well as, you know, just shows in a very poignant way the insanity of war, and how when people, you know, put down their weapons for a day and they went against their orders to continue the fighting, and they said, you know, screw this, basically. They said, it's Christmas, you know, and they realized, you know, they were, you know, sharing the same religion, and so they basically, you know, went across into the no man's land and you know, had a soccer game and shared wine and
and food and
pictures of their wives and girlfriends and it was just a really wonderful story.
They stopped being soldiers and started being human.
Exactly.
And you can do that. Anyone can do that anytime. Yes.
Right. Yeah. There's no aisle to reach across in truth, but in the dream, we think that there's a we, they, and so we need to work within that belief and, you know, reach across that to each other, whether it's on an individual level or a planetary level, you know, in this case. But it all boils down to the two thought systems, you know, thought systems of either inclusion or exclusion, huh?
Exactly, and that's exactly it. And so we have that choice. And being that we do have the choice, then, you know, that puts it straight in our laps, that we're the ones that, I mean, you and I, accepting the atonement for ourselves is not a small thing.
Right.
You know, I think I talked about this a little bit last week. You know, people are saying, well, you know, there, people are saying that Jesus says in the Course that, it's just a change in perception. And how can, you know, what is a change in perception has no meaning to them, because to them, that just means, oh, I think what I thought was bad is going to be okay now. That's not the change in perception. The change in perception is changing from perceiving things through the ego or perceiving things through the Christ mind. Mm-hmm. And I would tell you that makes a significant difference in everything. If you were seeing everything through the eyes of the Christ, you would absolutely see from a distance nothing is going wrong. Nothing has occurred. You put yourself into a place where you're actually seeing with the Holy Spirit that no one is being harmed. All of these things that we think are going wrong are really not. And the only thing that's wrong is our perception of them. And it really does make a huge difference. And it's changed me completely. Because every time I start to blame someone else or think something else is in charge or causing problems, or, you know, that, you know, Trump is going to cause a big disaster and all his choices for the cabinet are, you know, are terrifying and, you know, all that stuff. Nothing is going on. Nothing is terrifying. Mm-hmm. This is not more terrifying than when Barack Obama was elected, and look at how many people were just in horror and continue to this day to be in horror about Barack Obama being president. And what maybe to me, maybe you, I don't know how many other people, it's like amazing and joyful thing that he's our president, because I see him as such a good man. Other people see him as being an ogre or terrible, or like I tend to be seeing Donald Trump. So I just, that shift that came to me when I noticed that, now my nightmare that, you know, that I didn't understand their nightmare, I looked at their nightmare and said, well, that's just stupid. What a foolish thought. You know, how can you imagine that this good, good man is so terrible? Now the shoe is on the other foot. Because they're saying, look, you know, Trump's really a great guy and he's a go-getter and a mover and a shaker and he's not afraid of this and that. And, you know, they're really happy about it. And I'm looking at it saying, this is a disaster. It's the same thing. There's no order of difficulty in miracles. Mm-hmm. And the belief that there's something different or better about one than another is erroneous on my part completely. My belief that Obama is a great guy is just as foolish as my belief that Trump is a bad guy, because there it has nothing to do with either one of them.
Like Shakespeare said, there's nothing good or bad, but that thinking makes it so. Because essentially, if all illusions are the same, then any illusion is equally deserving of our compassion. Any identification with illusion, because obviously an illusion is nothing, but to the degree that our awareness that seems to be fragmented into these individual cells has identified with, you know, a good or bad persona or ethic or intent or whatever. I mean, that's the crazy thing, isn't it? Because only in a dream could that be possible, but we've so thoroughly identified with a dream that we think that's the real deal.
We think
that's who we are. So I think that ties into the question I was thinking we might want to read in the FAQs. Did I send that to you through the?
Yes, you did, and I
chat?
Got it up here.
Sound good to you?
It does sound good, and I'm going to post it in the room. Oops, no, I'm not going to post that in the room. What am I doing? Some other thing. Oh, I know, because I didn't copy it. I just and if people are wondering, it's Bruce Rawls that I'm on the phone with right now. Sometimes we got folks in here that are not usually up this time in the morning listening to us.
Okay.
So this is what we do on Saturday morning, is we get up and we go through these frequently asked questions in the database. So we're looking at this one, number 14.
1246.
This morning, 1246. So Bruce, you want to start reading the question? And
sure. There's a lot here, so we might have to pick up the pace to get through it, or just maybe keep our commentary a little bit lighter today, but there's a lot in this one. I think this one and the following one for next week, if we want to continue on, are both actually very timely in terms of, you know, the holiday season and, you know, what kind of ties in what you started out with, the real meaning of the season, which is, you know, the Christ consciousness, the awareness that we took with us into the dream that leads us away from the war and the fear and the craziness of the world. And that's really what's worthy of our celebration throughout the year. So I'll start by reading this question. These again, all
read the whole question.
Yeah, what Lynn and I have been doing for some time now, and this is probably over a year now, I think, isn't it? We've been reading mostly from the frequently asked questions from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, which is facim.org, and their question and answer service, which has over 1,300 wonderful questions, is at facimoutreach.org, and you can go through these sequentially and follow along with us if you want. And again, I will post these, as I have been doing, right along on acimblog.com. So if you miss any of this, or if you tuned in late, you can hear the audio replay that Lynn is thoughtful enough to send to me every week, and I upload and make a few comments on, and they're all on the website for your future review. So anyway, I'll read this.
Thank you, by the way. Bruce does a beautiful job of posting these on the website, so it's a very, very I feel very proud and joyful that that you do that, and you do such
well,
a
likewise. Likewise, and I appreciate all the efforts you do. I know you do a whole lot more than just this one weekly conversation with your involvement with Pal Talk and the ACIM Gather network. So I've just been diving into it, you know, a little snippet of it once a week, mostly for quite some time. But anyway, I'll go ahead and read the question. This is number 1246. And the summary is, what is the difference between the historical Jesus and the Jesus who dictated the course? And then the expanded question is, in answer to question number 265, you have written, it is important for students of the course not to confuse the voice Helen Schuckman heard and identified as Jesus's with the Jesus of traditional Christianity, nor to associate it with any particular image in form. The course uses the term Jesus and the Holy Spirit as symbols reflecting the part of the mind of the sonship that holds the memory of God. They are not real persons. And the question goes on. There seem to be two different, quote, realities, unquote, here, namely the ultimate reality, which is love, and the apparent historical reality, and then in parentheses, which, though illusory, would seem to have some validity for us when perceived correctly. And that's the end of the parentheses. Is there any reason why we should or should not regard the, quote, voice, unquote, that Helen identified as Jesus and which dictated A Course in Miracles to her as the voice of the historical Jesus? If we should not regard this voice as the voice of the historical Jesus, then what is the relationship between this voice and the historical Jesus? That's a really good question, I think, because, you know, we kind of assume that, you know, especially if we have a Western Christian upbringing, which I imagine a lot of listeners either have had or are certainly connected to plenty of people who have had that experience, and it sort of pervades our culture, which then, you know, because of the predominance of English and Western thinking, has kind of influenced a lot of the planet. So we kind of get it through osmosis, even if we're, you know, from an Aboriginal tribe in some remote part of the planet. We still get a pretty healthy dose of this, unless we've been living in isolation, you know, all our lives. So anyway, do you want to start with the answer?
Sure. And you know, I'm sure that the answer is going to say something of this nature, but there are a lot of course students who are just adamant, yes, it's the same historical Jesus. And, you know, my question is, well, you know, are we going to start picking and choosing which part of this illusion we believe is real? You know, and so we're going to believe that there was a real historical Jesus, even though we're told that the world is not real and nothing, there are no real persons or real personalities, but suddenly this Jesus guy is going to be real. You know, that's where there's a lot of confusion amongst people. So,
well, and that's a perfect example of level of confusion, because that's what our egos want to do. They want to drag anything that's real into the dream to make the dream real. That's the whole purpose of why we made up a world in the first place, to hide from what we thought was the perfect cosmic crime. But it never happened. So it's an unfounded, yet unconscious guilt, fear, sin syndrome.
Exactly. And Carrie writes in the room, a lot of people reduce the course to their understanding of the historical Jesus,
right.
Almost every course group. And that is very true.
Yeah.
That people come from a Christian background and they reduce the course to that Jesus, or they come from a non-Christian background and they reduce the course to that Jesus. And that Jesus, you know, as interesting as that character was, in a lot of cases did not reflect the Christ mind in his actions and his deeds, as for like turning over the tables in the temple, or there's so many examples of things that are not Christ-like that he allegedly did, that you really do have to separate, the song in Jesus Christ Superstar, if you separate the myth from the man, you will see what we all want to be. You know, that's it. Separating the myth from the man. So let me start reading the answer and see what the folks at the
Before you do, I would just make a lyric correction for our benefit as core students, which would be separating the myth from the true identity, because, you know, the person or the man or woman that we think we are is part of the myth. I mean,
it's
just a different illusion. But our real identity, which transcends space and time and any kind of label or division we could throw at it, obviously is what we're all aiming for and returning to in our mind, because that's where the peace is. That's where our the true solace of an uncorrupted innocence lives eternally, and that's what we're all wanting to remember consistently. I think we all get glimpses of it. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. It's really something you have to be constantly mindful of, because it's so easy to fall into.
Oh yeah.
And I know it is for me for sure, because I love Jesus. and people will think that you're negating Jesus by saying it's not the historical character. But I don't think so at all. I think it glorifies Jesus, the Christ, even more when you recognize that the flawed history of that character do not have anything to do with the reality of the man or the reality of the being. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. And you were.
Oh, I was just going to say it's a very schizophrenic portrayal that we get of both Jesus and his father, and using the biblical symbolism of, you know, God the Father, because we in both the Old and New Testaments we get a very, you know, divisive and schizophrenic. And one of the things that Ken Wapnick points out is, you know, in the Gospel of John, you know, when Jesus is talking to his church, he's basically saying, you know, you're the chosen people and everyone else is, you know, condemned to hell, essentially.
Yeah.
But you hear that a lot, you know, if you listen to fundamentalist Christian jargon, that there's a big divide and, you know, a fiery furnace and, you know, just pray that you're not on the wrong side of that when the judgment day comes, kind of thing. But that's not the message of the Course at all. And there's so many places where the Jesus of A Course in Miracles and the Jesus of traditional fundamentalist, anyway, Christianity, the non-esoteric Christianity, if you will, depart tremendously. There's also a book that Ken Wapnick co-wrote with a priest named, I think it's Norris Clark. I forget the exact name. Anyway, it's really well done, and they basically, you know, sort of have an agree to disagree conversation that's very civil and very, very kind spirited about the differences between A Course in Miracles and Christianity. If you want to further explore that topic, that's an excellent read, by the way. So anyway, should we actually get into it?
Yeah, let's go ahead and delve in. I just was going to add one thing in here, and that was I hear a lot of core students talk about, you know, when did Jesus awaken during his life? You know, when did this thing occur to him? And a lot of core students will bring up the Garden of Gethsemane and the little argument that he has with God in the Garden of Gethsemane and say it was at that point when he quit arguing that he was awake. But he was already, you know, walking on water and healing the sick and raising the dead since he came out of the desert. So historically, you know, it would seem he was already awakened when he came out of the desert. And so why would he go retro in the garden? And, you know, I look at that and I says, you know, well, first off, everyone who could have possibly heard that conversation was passed out drunk. And, you know, because he kept begging them, come wake up, come stay awake with me. And they were all passed out drunk. So who heard this conversation and who wrote it down?
And that presupposes that there was an actual historical personage that is identical to what's being, you know.
Exactly.
The seeming individual that is the voice of A Course in Miracles, which is not an individual at all. If we even get the least little bit of, inspiration from it. We quickly realized that, no, this is an awareness that comes from within all of us that has nothing to do with individuality. And so it's very oxymoronic to think of historical Jesus and, you know, the self that, capitalist self that, of course, miracles really reminds us to re-identify with. Yeah.
Right. They don't match. They just don't match. So common sense would tell you if it was one or the other, you know, you can choose which one you want. Do you want the Christ that is above the battleground, or do you want the Christ that's wallowing around in pity in the Garden of Gethsemane? And you know, I don't. And Danza says they were drunk. Of course they were drunk. They drank all during supper. They drank wine. They were all drunk and passed out. So, anyway, and he could have run away, but you know, that's a story. It's all a part of the story, and the story is not the reality of any part of it. So, you know, what is it that happened there? We don't really know, but it's set up historically, this whole Christianity thing. So let's see what Ken and the folks at the foundation have to say. So he says, as much as we would like it to be, this is not a simple matter of is he or isn't he. That is because of the course's uncompromising view of reality as non-dualistic, a oneness joined as one, which is a quote from the course, which cannot be understood by us in our separated state, from chapter 25. This non-dualism is expressed in the course's definition of heaven as, quote, an awareness of perfect oneness and the knowledge that there is nothing else, nothing outside this oneness, and nothing else within. I mean, that could have been a quote straight from Nisargadatta or straight from Ramana Maharshi or the Vedas or any of the, you know, it's an awareness of perfect oneness and the knowledge that there is nothing else, nothing outside this oneness and nothing else within. Which, again, you know, that is a perfect definition to me of non-dualism. And yet there are a lot of course students who say, I don't understand, Jesus doesn't talk about non-dualism. But, of course.
Not in those words, but. Throughout the whole course. I think that's where we're really privileged and fortunate to have, you know, the work of Ken Wapnick, wonderful legacy and, you know, prolific legacy. Of the material that he shares, and you can go to the YouTube channel for Foundation for A Course in Miracles and watch lots of videos, and as well as, you know, just a prolific number of books and audios, and they're just all wonderful. And he really explains in such great detail how the non-dualism of the Course comes through, even though it doesn't use that jargon. You know, the double shield of oblivion is only mentioned once, but that concept appears many, many times throughout the course, and so many things that, you know, you can put into different language, and Ken does a great job of, you know, reiterating and translating without changing the meaning of the course and putting it out there in a way that, you know, we can access it, you know, more easily. So highly recommend for any course student that is not familiar with Ken's work. It's just such a gold mine of, you know, revelatory stuff. And then of course, Gary Renard's work is a nice complement to that. I think of that as sort of the appetizer and dessert for the main course of Ken's material.
I agree too.
And you mentioned Nisargadatta and Ramana Maharshi. You know, I really haven't taken much time to look at those, but everything I've seen from them indicates that they were completely tapped into the non-dual understanding as well. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's see. let us just continue here. This says, okay, so I posted in the room, an awareness of perfect oneness and the knowledge that there is nothing else, nothing outside of this oneness and nothing else within. That is a perfect definition of non-dualism.
Yeah.
Non-dualism means that both spirit and matter, mind and body, cannot be real. That would be dualism. So it's be God and other, right? Thus, all multiplicity is illusory as well as time and space. Statements expressing this contrast between reality and illusion are what we call level one of the course's presentation. So this this idea of levels is so very important, because once I comprehended, oh, this is what he's talking about, that, you know, these different levels of thinking are really thinking with the ego or thinking with the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. And on the one level, is all of this, you know, reality of the world. And on the other level is all of this, reality of heaven. And neither of the two can mix, and only one is real. And so, you know, if it's not reflecting heaven, it's reflecting something that doesn't exist and is impossible. And so, you know, that when people get confused, and there's a lot, I mean, seriously, level confusion is rampant. And denial of that level confusion is rampant also, because people want to believe what comforts them. Mm-hmm. And somehow it's comforting to believe that some part of this illusion is real.
Although I would suggest it's not a very effective comfort. It's just like anything in ego strategy. It's, if you look at its effectiveness, it really is just
a house of cards.
There's the word I'm thinking of. It doesn't really work. It basically just gives us a way to delay the inevitable facing of the choice in the mind, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's just like any magic thought is basically a mechanism for postponing looking at the cause, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, because there's nothing wrong with illusion. It's just that it doesn't make us happy.
The thing about illusion that doesn't make us happy is the very thing that should make us happy. The thing about illusion that doesn't make me happy is that it's not permanent. The things I like are not permanent, and the things that I don't like tend to be too permanent. So, you know, it really, you know, if I could just get, you know, that idea that there's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. There's nothing right or wrong, but thinking makes it so. There is no behavior that's approved and a behavior that's not approved. It's thinking that makes it so. So, you know, even me saying, you know, these police officers that are going around taking away the blankets from homeless people, you know, I know that they hate themselves for doing that, because they believe that what they're doing is wrong. I know that, and if they do justify it for themselves, they can only justify it by denying their own human kindness, their own human desire to be loving, and that's painful. So, you know, it can only cause you pain. Right. And so, you know, if you didn't have that sense of responsibility for behavior, or thinking that somehow or the other I can change the script, then, because it's in the script that I, a police officer, I'm going to take away this man's blanket. And, you know, I'm doing it, and should I feel guilty about it? Well, if it's something that has been a part of this ego story from the very beginning, and, you know, I'm just riding the wave of it, then there's no reason for me to feel guilty. I didn't invent it. I didn't make it up. I just have to live with it now, and justify in my head how it is that I can do this. And if I believe that I'm bad and I believe that it's wrong, then I'm going to feel guilty. And if I believe that it's just what's happening and I have no more choice about this than I do about breathing, I have no more choice about this than I do about blinking my eyes, growing my hair, these are all things that are happening in this script, and none of which I have any control. Please believe me, you have no control over the story. You have no control over your role in the script. The only thing you have control over is your own thinking about it.
Interpretation.
Interpretation. And when I stop interpreting and being afraid, then I see that there is a different way of seeing things. And that all of the, you know, all of it, there's no one is actually suffering from this. This is only a perception of suffering because we have a perception of being physical bodies, perception of living in a physical world, perception of cold, perception of hard ground, whatever it is that we're perceiving, none of that is real. That's all part of the story.
Yeah, which I'm glad you mentioned perception again, because earlier you brought that word up and I was thinking that because A Course in Miracles is always and only about the mind, even though as egos we want to make it everything but that, the perception that's referred to in A Course in Miracles, it has nothing to do with the photons hitting your retinas or the pressure waves hitting your eardrums, although we certainly want to make it about that. The perception that in A Course in Miracles is talking about is the interpretation or translation that we choose moment to moment about the dream that we made up that we call material reality. And so that interpretation really is boils down to and distills to a choice of teacher. So if we have a teacher that suggests that we're all one thing, which kind of gets into the level two awareness, which is the forgiveness, which is itself an illusion, but it's the only illusion that gets us back to the reality. So we have a choice among illusions in the dream to choose a perception, if you will, or an interpretation that suggests that everything is either a call for love or an expression of love. And that classroom of forgiveness gets us out of identifying with the dream figures that we think we are. And so that's where our freedom really lies.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Do you want to finish that first paragraph?
Okay.
We're close.
Yeah, we're close. Okay. Yeah. So non-dualism means that both spirit and matter, mind and body, cannot be real. So both spirit and matter, or mind and body, cannot be real. You can't have one and have the other. It's polar opposites. So that would be dualism. Thus, all multiplicity is illusory as well as time and space. Statements expressing this contrast between reality and illusion are what we call level one of the course's presentation. Yeah, I did finish reading that paragraph. So I'll let you read the next one.
Okay. All right. The issue then is how to conceptualize and talk about what certainly appears to be real to us but is not. The initial stage of communication would be to use our language and concepts about individual persons living in a physical universe and then teach us how to interpret our experiences here differently. This is level two of the course's presentation, the first part that contrasts wrong-minded and right-minded perception. This, which we were just talking about, this would eventually lead to a recognizing that our specifics-oriented perception is seriously distorted and that everything we perceive is really a symbol, either of our mind's choice to identify with the ego thought system of separation or the Holy Spirit's correction of that, the thought system of forgiveness. This approach of A Course in Miracles is made especially explicit in Lesson 184 and also in Jesus' injunction that we not confuse symbol and source. And there's a reference to section 4 of chapter 19. To cite just two references, viewing everything as symbolic, including ourselves, enables us to function purposefully in the world while we still think it is real, and at the same time be oriented toward regaining awareness of our true identity that lies beyond all symbols, as beautifully explained in the three sections in the text, which I'm inspired now to reread again, Beyond the Body, chapter 18, section 6, Beyond All Symbols, chapter 27, section 3, and Beyond All Idols in chapter 30, section 3. So, yeah, lots in there, huh? But again, in order to get back to that awareness, we need to use the symbols, including the bodies and personas that we think we are, and, you know, as long as it's meaningful to us, something that may be, you know, sort of an equivalent or hopefully an upgrade to the historical Jesus that's presented in the Christian Bible, that is modified heavily by the corrections that A Course in Miracles provides. So those can be then symbols for renavigating through our mind back to the awareness that we never left. And that's where our forgiveness classroom comes in. And the classroom of shared interest, which ties into what we've been talking about right along this morning, of seeing how we're all in the same boat. We have very different perspectives based on the dream stories that we tell ourselves through the media, through our political affiliations, through the social connections we have and our familial and all that kind of stuff. But it's really just a matter of a choice in the mind. It's really simple. It really distills down to just which one of two thought systems, as this paragraph suggests. So.
Exactly. And that's it. And I love that the references that they give are sections that are called beyond. Beyond body, beyond all symbols, beyond all idols. And it made me think of the Heart Sutra, which is a you're familiar with the Heart Sutra, is a sutra that is basically saying I've gone beyond, all is nothing. Basically, is the statement of a person who is awakened, is that I've gone beyond, and now I see that all is nothing. And there's a lot of different interpretations of it, but basically that's what it's all about. This is what Jesus is telling us. You know, when you go beyond these things, then when you look, and it always still reminds me of that song from Bette Midler, From a Distance, because that's what really it's all about. God is watching us from a distance. God doesn't see the details and the trivia and all the crap that we think is real and is really going on. God just sees us as we are. So, you know, God just sees Lynn as the spirit, the Christ. God sees Bruce as the Christ, so he doesn't see any difference between you and me and Donald Trump and Hitler and Mother Teresa. You know, none of us are more or less deserving of his love. None of us are more or less worthy of being. And in fact, none of us are even those personas that I've just referenced. That is not who or what we are at all. Those are storybook characters. And so, you know, God's not looking at the storybook characters and saying, well, I like this character better than the other. You know, it's like anything. We made it to entertain ourselves, basically. And, or I don't know why. And I don't know if anybody really does know why. There's no comprehensive why, because how can there be a why of something that never occurred? I mean, that's it answers it right in itself, right? but the whole idea then that the individual character is responsible for anything that it does in the dream is really ludicrous. And really the basis for forgiveness, the real justification for forgiveness, which we just were reading a couple days ago from the text, the real justification for forgiveness is nothing ever happened. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the script is written says that you and I don't have any choice over our actions, even right now what we're doing and saying. This is all part of the script. I'm not making up some new part of the script. I'm not contributing something new and different to what never was. And, you know, you and I can take this seriously, that this is really important that we're doing this. But the reality of it is, the only important thing is that, you know, I'm seeing through the veil. You know, I'm I'm seeing that there's nothing past those clouds. And that, you know, the truth and the reality is that nothing could have ever come to upset heaven or disturb the peace of heaven. So there's no struggle, there's no going to, there's no trying to, there's actually no beyond, because what could beyond be beyond if there is nothing nothing here? So anyway.
Certainly in the context of that we normally think in terms of there's nothing beyond. I think that's where one of the things I really like that about you know, Ken Wapnick's work, where he talks about, you know, the contribution of Eastern mysticism is it basically negates the ego. But what of course, A Miracle adds to that is twofold, in the sense is that it provides us with the purposiveness of the ego, which is basically to obscure and to deny. And it basically says, well, that the purpose of the world and the ego and its whole thought system is to obfuscate, to hide, to deceive and conceal the love that's beyond it. But that's, I think, where you know, again, that sort of a Western concept that the Course adds to the Eastern mysticism is that the love that's behind the special love and the special hate and the deception and all the duality is really what we're drawn to. And if we just stop, you know, like the real alternative section, which is one of my favorites in the last chapter of the text, that, you know, says, you know, if you just stop there, you know, you're going to get depressed and discouraged and you know, you're going to have a dark night of the soul, because that point, that precipice, requires our trust to go beyond, and our trust in our inner kindness teacher to go beyond that, beyond the interpretation of thinking, well, gee, if I let go of the self, you know, little less self, what is there? Well, the little less self is the infinitesimal drop, and the real less self is the ocean. And the ocean is the self that we all share, but we're not aware of that for the most part. But that's where the love is. That's where the real peace beyond comprehension is.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it entirely. And so, because the Course added this, which apparently was not included, or I don't know if it wasn't included or it just wasn't emphasized or seen in that way, this relationship business. Buddhism is a lot about that, okay? Because Buddhism is a lot about looking at the suffering of the world, and you know, really, it is all about suffering. Buddhism, which I was a Buddhist for a long time, so you know, I know all about it. You know, you're just going around, you know, trying to alleviate suffering, and that's a big mm-hmm. part of it, is this alleviation of suffering. And the reason that even though I love Buddhism and I love the tenets of it and find them very, very helpful, I had to step away from that belief in suffering, because that firmly entrenched belief in suffering that is kind of the basis of the work that Buddhists do is the antithesis of what Jesus is telling me in the Course. Right. And so where the tenets of Buddhism are all, you know, an alignment, the premise of it is that, you know, that, I mean, it was one of the main tenets of Buddhism is that suffering does exist. And, the same thing, I mean, all of these beliefs that have been turned into religions have come up with tenets that are part of the truth, and yet have these deep flaws. So, well, I call it flaw. I don't know, because if I hadn't been a Buddhist, I don't seriously believe that I would have been would have taken up the Course as rapidly. And, but getting over that belief in suffering was very, very difficult. And in fact, I still believe in suffering. I still feel sad for people. I still want to help people. And I'll give an example as somebody here in this room too. You know, I looked at someone I saw in this room and, saw that they seemed to be in need, and I love them and I want to help them. And so, I sent them some money. Not a lot, but I sent them some money because, you know, I wanted them to, you know, be happy. Well, what that person did was they had a neighbor, young family, and the young man had gotten cancer and he died. that person took that money I gave them out of my belief and love and belief that they could use it to alleviate their suffering, and they gave that money to those people because they saw that as alleviating their suffering. So, and it's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. And you know, I love it. But then I have to go back to what was the basic premise on which I was doing it. You know, I wanted to stop a person from suffering or give them some joy. That's kind of what I was thinking. This would make them really happy. But the joy that I gave them was not that they suddenly had some extra money to spend. The joy that I gave them was the joy of being able to help someone else out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of the, you know, that's where I get stuck, though, because I still think that I can change what another person's experience is. You know, I still think that I can be the hero and change your perception and give you a better experience. And I can't. It's not up to me. I'm the only one whose experience can change, and I'm the only one that can be satisfied with what it is. So that's a off topic, but just, you know, when he's talking about beyond, this really is going beyond these concepts and these ideas, and bring it right back into, you know, what am I really doing here? Am I really here to try to save the world?
Right.
Or am I here to go beyond and, you know, and not even caring if other people get to go beyond.
Yeah. Yeah. But we can use the world as the means to go beyond it, just as we can use it, our belief in a separate self as a mechanism to go beyond that. So, do you want to go beyond the second paragraph?
I'll go beyond the second paragraph. Okay. Okay. We might get through this. Although this is not usually in our awareness, but is what the exercises in the workbook help bring into our awareness, we are always choosing either to deny the truth or to ask for help to remove the interferences we are making to our awareness of truth. So those are the things where we're either denying the truth or asking for help to remove the blocks, the interferences that we are making to our awareness of truth. When we choose to undo these interferences, we allow it to happen gradually, which means we do not suddenly let go of our identity as individual persons and accept our identity as spirit without reservations. We are too fearful of doing that. And this is true. Absolutely true. We are too fearful of doing that. And again, I hate to keep going into my musings here, but I was thinking about this the other day, you know, saying, you know, I want to call to the Christ in Donald Trump to wake up and to guide him. And I thought, well, that's friggin' ludicrous, because the Christ in Donald Trump is wide awake. It's only the Donald Trump that's unaware of that.
And more to the point, it's really my projection. Yes. Of anyone else, including political figures, that it requires my attention.
Exactly.
And that's such a difficult thing to remember, because we've so conditioned ourselves, and we've made up a cast of characters that are reading from the same script, but we can change, you know, which director's cut we're listening to, and there's an alternate director's cut that suggests that we can see everything as either a call for love or an expression of love, and that changes everything. That
exactly.
Really changes everything. And we begin to pull our projections back into our own mind, and then heal them where they originated, because ideas don't leave their source.
Exactly. And so if we're fearful, and this is what is happening, is that it's fear that keeps me from doing that, then we let love in stages, which is what this is saying, or increments, according to what our fear will allow us to tolerate. Jesus tells us that the very origin of the body is our mind's belief in limited love. Quote, it was made to limit the unlimited. Therefore, to the extent that we believe our bodily identity is our real identity, we will continue to perceive love in those terms. Love is abstract and formless, but as long as we think we are individuals, we will perceive love as limited or as form in some way. This is not wrong. It is an important first step that would lead to delay in one's progress if skipped, for it gets us on the right ladder, and I think he's referring to like the ladder of prayer, with the right teacher. But it is also important to realize that relating to Jesus as a person is a stage in our spiritual journey. And so for those who just came in, the question is about, you know, Jesus of the Bible, or Jesus, is there a real Jesus person? And so relating to that person as Jesus was very instrumental in my journey, that's for sure, throughout my life, and starting from when I was a small child and a Catholic to, you know, seeing and hearing Jesus Christ Superstar and falling in love with Jesus, the man, the Son of God, to, you know, where now I see that Jesus, he's us. So it does change, it does shift things.
Yep. Okay. Oh, how about if I read the next paragraph here?
How about that? Go ahead.
Okay. Jesus reflects the formless love of God, but is not identical with that love. The passage we quoted from the clarification of terms in the question you cited, number 265, is relevant here. Thus, if my identity as an individual symbolizes my mind's belief in a real existence outside God and heaven, and then my mind decides to undo that mistaken belief and accept the truth will be symbolized in a way that is meaningful and understandable by my mind. If I think of myself as an individual, then I need love to be present to me in the form of an individual. Otherwise, I would not recognize it or be able to relate to it. The Jesus of the Course speaks to us in a personal way, and he encourages us to accept him into our lives as we would an older, wiser brother who knows what is best for us. And we ought to do that. In fact, he tells us, if it helps you, think of me holding your hand and leading you, and I assure you this will be no idle fantasy. So in other words, you know, whatever metaphor, you know, it's essentially it's kind of like, you know, saying this is magic because, you know, forgiveness isn't real, but it's the way to get out of unreality by using an illusion that undoes the illusion. And so if along the same lines, if it helps us, which I would think for the vast majority of people, who, you know, aren't totally, enmeshed in the idea of pure abstraction and a lot of, you know, esoteric Eastern ideas along those lines that you were touching on, you know, for most of us, we're going to find a great help and solace in the idea of a symbolic brother that's wiser, older, and you know, more savvy about this stuff, that is present within us, in our mind, that's helping us every moment and available 24/7, 365 to lead us out of the identification with the dream that we made up.
Yeah, and what's so funny about that, Bruce, is that you know, when you recognize that, you realize it's been in your mind all the whole time. You were the one, it's always been there. You were the one who decided every single step of every single bit of it. And, it didn't come from some outside, you know, character that was blessing you or sending you something or, you know, dying for your sins or any of that. It's all in the mind. It's all in my mind, every bit of it. So in my relationship with Jesus, you know, the voice of Jesus that Helen heard. I know there's going to be a lot of controversy. People think that this is not true because there are. This is the major controversy here: is the belief that there was a Jesus outside of Helen talking to her, another character talking to her, or that what she heard and reflected came from that universal mind that came from inside of her. It didn't come from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Because it couldn't have come from anywhere else.
Right.
And this is the huge major confusion that people who study the Course, including me, have, is this belief that there is a God or a Jesus or anything outside of me. And the fact is, it's not possible. If I'm getting signals from somewhere outside of me, then that means that there is something. There are two things, at least two things. And if there's only one, there can't be two.
Yeah. And I think it's helpful while we're going through this process of undoing our egos to identifying with what we really are, which is that self that we, capital S self that we're talking about, that we use placeholder ideas like Jesus or the Holy Spirit or inner kindness teacher or whatever works for you. Those are helpful. So why not use those? And I'm reminded of about 2 decades ago, I started getting up in the morning early and writing on my computer and I was doing channeling, I guess you could call it. And I recognized that at that time, it was like, this was this long lost part of myself that I had, neglected, and usually the writings started with, kind of welcome back kind of language. And I don't know if I think those may be on a hard drive somewhere in a closet or who knows where, but anyway, I was doing that off and on for a year or two, and then I realized, well, when I, got back into the Course, it was like, well, it's the same voice. It's the same voice we all share, the same truth that we all have.
Yeah.
The same gentle awareness that leads us back to the peace that we never left. And for me, it took the form, in my mind of a kind, gentle, very, an unshakable highest possible integrity, comforting beyond anything I could imagine awareness.
And I think from you.
What's that?
So it couldn't have come from you.
Well, yeah, certainly not the self that I think I am most of the time. So, but I think that's the self, the capital S self that we all share.
That
this curriculum is helping us reconnect with. And the more that we begin to identify with that, the more we take on that identity, not on a level of form, but in our mind. And that's I think, why the Course says that, the last thing is the final step is, we get the little S self out of the way completely. And God, the metaphor that's used in A Course in Miracles is God taking the final step. But essentially there's no steps, there's no ladder, there's no, in truth, that's the beyond, there's nothing, in truth that has to do with form or symbols or placeholder metaphors. But we live in a world of metaphors, and we need to use those while we think we're here.
Right. We're limited to that. And that's, again, that last line that said about being limited to the body. It was made to limit the unlimited. That's the ego mind. Everything was made to limit the unlimited.
Yeah.
And that's its purpose. And
exactly.
So, and it's just doing its job. It's just doing its purpose. It's doing what it's here for. So, I can't blame it either. And there's nothing to blame. It's just, a mistaken identity. But nothing is being harmed by it.
Right.
Jesus tells us, you're not really being hurt. Nothing really is going on. But, you're just prolonging your, adventure into something that is, you say is not happy, making you happy.
Right, right.
But obviously it is making us happy, or else we wouldn't be doing it. If it's our choice to be here and to be, going through war in Aleppo or, stubbing my toe when I got out of bed, that's my choice. And, as long as I continue to choose that, I'll continue to do that. And until I recognize, I'm the one who's making all this up, and let it go, that doesn't mean that still there won't be a war in Aleppo. It'll just mean that I recognize, there's nothing really going on here. These things I'm seeing are not distressful because I recognize that, it's no different. There's no order of difficulty in miracles. everything is basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. So let's see. So let's go on to, I've moved now. So did you read Jesus Reflects the Formless Love of
yes.
God?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So. Okay. All right. I had scrolled away from it. So, okay. Let's see. So, yeah, although he has presented us in this way, he is presented in this way, speaking to us as individuals, he also makes it clear that we are involved in a process of climbing up the ladder that separation led us down. The top of the ladder is the transcendence of individuality, because at that stage we no longer value existence that keeps us separate from God and from each other. We have realized that that was the source of all our pain and conflict. We realize that there is really no self that is separate from other selves and from God, and we would have become identified with love, no longer relating to it as one specific form to another. We would have become one with the love that inspired the Course, no longer needing its specific form. That's why we can put down this world, put down this Course, and come to our God with holy empty hands. This is the return to the oneness of ourself as God's one Son, Christ. And quote from the workbook, let's see, I always get confused about how the, is it lesson five or is it, okay.
Yeah.
Identify with love and you are safe. Identify with love and you are home. Identify with love and you find yourself. And that is with the capital S. So if you identify with love, you're safe, you're home, and you find yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good news.
Yeah, yeah. And that's all by just looking without condemnation at the craziness of the ego thought system and saying, you know, not this moment. Maybe not today, but not this moment. Yeah. Okay, the next paragraph goes on with, the principle of the Course's non-dualism and the Course's aim of restoring to our awareness our oneness with the formless love of God, quote, a oneness joined as one, which from chapter 25, section 1, from which we are never truly separated, must be taken into account when one thinks about the nature and origin of the voice Helen heard. A voice is specific. An historical person is specific. Therefore, to say without qualification that the voice she heard was the voice of the historical Jesus is to distort and severely dilute the profound and radical message of A Course in Miracles. Well, that could be underlined, huh? Moreover,
yeah, that's pretty amazing.
It really is. I mean, because basically you're bringing a profound awareness that we all share down to a very fragmented and limited one, if we try to do that. Moreover, in light of biblical scholarship, one must draw a distinction between the historical Jesus and the biblical accounts of his life and message. The conclusions drawn by a significant number of scholars is that these accounts are not accurate, and therefore we actually know very little about the historical figure. There's plenty of contradictions there, not to mention the message of that seems very schizophrenic about both God and his son Jay, to say the least. Okay. And so it is safe to say that the Jesus of the Course is not the New Testament version of him. His message in the Course differs decidedly from that presented in the Bible. See, for example, Atonement Without Sacrifice, chapter 3, section 1 of the text, and the message of the crucifixion, chapter 1, section 1 of chapter 6, where he tells us that his message, what his message really is. There are many more. Other questions on the service address this as well. 473, part 2, and 505, for example. So, anyway, yeah, basically, if we're trying to you know, It's essentially, it's that whole level confusion thing. Once again, is if we're trying to bring the identity, which is a formless, little s self, selfless, and spaceless, timeless identity that we really are drawn to, down to a specific, we're saying, I'm going to take the ocean that's being offered by the Course and reduce it to a microscopic, submicroscopic droplet of water.
That's
just silly. But it's understandable because we're so identified with our little submicroscopic droplet selves that are really nothing. It's more like a homeopathic concoction of water. There's nothing really there. It's just, it's been diluted so many times that there's really nothing there, but it seems like there's something there. And that's what seems is the symbol. But we've got everything backwards. We think that the abstract is fake and symbols aren't real. The symbols that we think are the course represents, but we have everything in upside down and backwards. And what we really are is the truth that is beyond any kind of symbolic representation. And that's what the Course is reminding us, that our essence is that. And that's where the joy we can't even begin to imagine, at least in the context of the self we think we are, is waiting for us to for our return.
Absolutely. And it's so funny, there's some people just dig into the Course, and this next paragraph is going to talk about the voice that Helen heard, but people just dig into the Course seriously, there's a new version coming out where Robert Perry and the people in the Circle of Atonement have gone through Helen's notes and rewritten the Course based on what they perceive from Helen's notes. And and they've got a lot of footnotes and, a lot of different features in the book. I'm going to buy it. I don't care. I just want to see what their curiosity, I guess, what their conclusions are. I see, including myself, people going through the Course looking for, and I'm not saying they're doing this, but it seems like, I see it a lot and I hear it a lot, looking for an out, looking for, there must be an easier way to do this. I got a new book, A Course in Miracles Made Simple. There must be an easier way to do this. And, I'm digging through this pile of shit. I know there's got to be a pony in there somewhere. That's the way they're looking at it. They're thinking there's got to be something. There must be a secret that Jesus gave Helen, because in a lot of cases they're looking for doing physical miracles, like, raising the dead and healing the sick, which Jesus says you absolutely can do. They're looking for, tricks and other ways of seeing it, maybe that they didn't see before. And I agree, they're not seeing it, because if they were actually seeing it, they would know that there is nothing else. You can look in every book, you can dissect every word, you can go to the dictionary, you can do everything. There is nothing else. You're just going to come up to the end with, this world is not real, and, you got to forgive it. Let it go. Uh-huh. You're not going to get out of that. But again, from reading Robert Perry and his basic premises, they do believe, there are a group of people who actually do believe that Jesus is talking about the world in terms of the physical world. That this world is actually real and was created by God. I know it's hard to believe, but there are people who read the Course and believe this. Because of, when Jesus says world so many times and gives examples that would lead them to believe it. And I read those examples and I say, yeah, that would lead me to believe that, he's, implying that the world is real and God made it. But if I read the entire body of the work and see what it is that he's asking us to do, then that can't possibly be true. Just like it can't possibly be true that, he was a man who walked the earth, healed the sick, raised the dead, and was crucified and returned from the dead. that can't possibly be true either, because it's all a story that was written long ago and was not a note in Heaven's Song was missed. It never happened. And that's, you know, if you could get over the, I think it really did happen, and it never happened, which is what Jesus is telling us, you would get over a lot, and you'd be really able to see a lot about what this course is teaching us. But if you want to hold on to both things, yes, the world is real, but it never happened, you're going to be confused, and that's not helpful.
Right. Yeah, that ties into a conversation I had with Susan Dugan a couple days ago that I put on ACIM blog about the section from chapter 14 about perceiving with the Holy Spirit, and which starts out suggesting that, you know, we want to try to maintain two thought systems. We want to try to maintain two perceptions because we're not ready to give it up. And to the degree that we resist the message that's behind the words in the Course in Miracles, we're basically saying, you know, get out of my mind, Jesus. the Jesus of the Course. Now we might embrace the historical Jesus, because that's actually a pretty schizophrenic figure. But the Jesus of the Course is uncompromising in the kindest possible way, in the most high integrity, loving, gentle way. We can't even imagine, really. But that's the awareness that we're all looking for, is that awareness that where there is no need to try to drag anything less than the quality that we really want into our mind. Yeah. Do you want to read the last paragraph?
Because we got a couple minutes. So what Helen heard, therefore, was a reflection of the formless love of heaven in a form that part of the sonship could relate to and recognize as loving. Many other forms are possible, and that's in the teacher's manual. The love that inspired the course is all that is truly healing, and eventually identifying with that love is the aim of our work with it. The form known as A Course in Miracles is merely a learning aid that we can use, if we are comfortable with it, to help us reach the point where we realize that the love that inspired this course is all that is real in our own minds. Jesus reflects that to us until we can accept it as our own identity. And thus you are joined with me, so what I am, you are as well. And that's from the workbook, from part two, paragraph 14. Lesson 14. This would be the acceptance of the atonement, the undoing of our belief that separation from God is possible and has truly happened. And that's it. You know, the idea that separation of God is possible, from God is possible, and that we actually did it.
That's a scary thought.
Scary. It's terrifying. But
we're given a very comforting alternative, aren't we?
Absolutely.
A real alternative. Yeah.
All right.
Well, thanks again, Lynn. I always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today at the House of the Risen Sun. And we're going to let go of the mic and turn it over to Devin and Barb. And I see Teddy's in the room. Good morning, Teddy. Love you all. And Devin and Barb, this mic is all yours.
Love to all. Have a great week.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye, Bruce.